Namaste, Jai Hind. You're watching or listening to the ANI podcast with Smita Prakash. Thank you for liking or subscribing to the channel and sharing these conversations from those who you think will benefit from listening or watching them. Since there's been an overdose of domestic political news in the media in India and abroad, we decided to shift the needle a little bit. Our podcast today is on future wars. Last year, we saw Hamas launch an asymmetrical war on Israel, and then Israel launched counter-offensive measures. The Ukraine-Russia war is in its third year. The Taiwan-China conflict seems more like when it happens rather than if it happens. And then there are civil wars currently on in many parts of the world. In an increasingly volatile world, where does India stand and how do we plan for the future? With me is the director of the Manohar Parikar Institute of Defence Studies and Analysis, Ambassador Sujan Chinoy. He's been India's envoy in Japan, Mexico, Belize. He's also served as India's Consul General in China, Shanghai, and Australia, Sydney. Ambassador Chinoy has served in the National Security Council Secretariat in the Prime Minister's office in New Delhi. I'm joined in the podcast with ANI's National Security Editor, Ajit Dubey. Ambassador Chinoy, thank you so much for being part of the podcast. Usually, Ajit and I have this free-flowing conversation on the podcast, but today I want to have a more structured kind of a conversation where I want to talk about future wars and also about current wars which are on and how India can recalibrate its position with regard to these conflicts. But before that, I want to talk about the recently hosted conference that you had where Chinese scholars came in from the Shanghai Institute for International Studies. What was it that you discussed about rebuilding ties between India and China?
Well, first of all, thank you very much for inviting me to your podcast.
Thank you.
I'd like to begin by saying the facts, stating the facts about the visit of the Chinese delegation. The Chinese Institutes for International Studies in Shanghai, popularly known as the SIIS, they are an old partner organization for IDSA. In fact, over the years, we've had many dialogues with them, and it was their idea to come to India. And they had requested us to facilitate their visit. And we were ready to do that because it's the job of think tanks to engage in dialogue. And that is how they came here. Mm-hmm. Much of our discussion and discourse was focused on rebuilding trust because currently there is utter lack of trust in our bilateral relations, particularly following the bloody incidents at Galwan in 2020. It's not entirely true that we have not had visitors come in or interact with our scholars because episodically there have been individual scholars that have come in even from China, perhaps at the invitation of other think tanks, and we have interacted with the visiting Chinese scholars earlier as well. But yes, I would say that during COVID, there was obviously a problem about offline and physical meetings. And some of it had to do with availability as well, because I was personally caught up the whole of last year with the G20 presidency as the Think20 chair for India's G20 presidency. And on their side also, it's not very easy to put together a large delegation, as in about five people, to come and visit India in person. But in a sense, I think it's right to say that this time around the visas were given. I don't think it's very difficult for scholars to get visas, in my view. Mm-hmm. So they have got their visas.
There's so much of distrust between India and China for now. Close to four years, 2020, wasn't it?
So
4 years, there's been literally the track two has also got fractured because of Chinese aggression. And then recently, China just continued its path of provocating India, with Beijing naming more than 30 places in Arunachal Pradesh, renaming them. They've done this before. It's nothing new. But then on the one hand, they want to build trust with us. And on the other, they continue with this path that they've taken in the past, which is like, continuing to provoke us.
So I think I'd like to point out the fact that even in the aftermath of Galwan, in the immediate aftermath of Galwan, dialogue was not disrupted. Mm-hmm. In fact, dialogue did continue. I recall that IDSA engaged in a dialogue which had been decided earlier with the CICIR, which is another think tank associated with the Ministry of State Security in Beijing, within the first week of Galwan. Mm-hmm. So it's probably not accurate to say that dialogue has been disrupted. In fact, dialogue has continued at multiple levels. It's continued at the political level, for you are aware that the External Affairs Minister of India has met his counterpart on a number of occasions physically since Galwan. I recall that the Defense Minister of India, Shri Rajnath Ji, has also met his counterpart on the margins of the SCO on more than one occasion, I think twice. And you also have the core commanders who have been meeting regularly. For that matter, even the WMCC, which is headed by the Joint Secretary in the Ministry of External Affairs, they have also met regularly. Quite recently, they met for the 29th time. But you'd be right to say that the think tank dialogue had actually become an online dialogue. But it had continued throughout these past 3 years. In the case of IDSA also, we've had multiple dialogues in the past 3 years online with not only the SIIS, but also with CICIR KIKIR in Beijing, and with the Institute for South Asian Studies in Sichuan University. The last one, in fact, is also quite important because the chief of that delegation was none other than Mr. Taiping Kuo, the former special representative, mm-hmm. who I have engaged for the last 3 years. Okay. And so the deal was that he would put together a team on their side and I would put together a team on my side, and that we would have a regular annual dialogue.
What does it achieve? What do these talks achieve?
I think it allows the two sides to take a hard look at the differences that we have and to put across our point of view quite bluntly and frankly. But may I turn briefly to the question of why build trust or why rebuild trust? The reason is that there is absolutely an utter lack of trust right now between the two sides, for good reasons. For the Chinese have actually created the situation by their disregard for all the bilateral agreements and protocols that persons like me have so assiduously worked on over the decades. In the case of the Chinese, they created an abnormal situation in the India-China boundary areas. And at the same time, they have been asking for a normalization of ties across the border. Mm. Now, our key point there is that we can normalize the existence of a bilateral dispute. That's not a new thing. Mm. The existence of a bilateral dispute between India and China over the boundary question is hardly new. But we cannot normalize bloodshed in our bilateral ties. And the current situation is one which is, in fact, harboring such potential, continues to harbor such potential. So until and unless peace and tranquility is restored to the border areas and the situation is restored to normalcy, we cannot imagine that the rest of the relationship can continue to pretend as if there is no change in the India-China border areas. Yeah. The third point that you raised was about the renaming of places in Arunachal Pradesh. And as you rightly pointed out, that's hardly new. The Chinese have a consistent position about Arunachal Pradesh. And they call it Tsangnan, as you know, so-called Tsangnan. And they have obviously, you know, renamed for their own internal purposes some places there, which really should make no difference to us.
Yeah.
But they've done it in 2017. They've done it in 2021, 2023, and now again in 2024. My own view is that we must reject this kind of, you know, insidious activity on their part. These pronouncements must be condemned. But at the same time, we should also be quite ready, in my view, since we show the whole of Aksai Chin, rightly so, as Indian territory, we must also give some appropriate Hindi names to each of the, you know, new villages and townships that they might have created in Aksai Chin. If you look at the map of India today, Aksai Chin is an integral part of India.
Yeah.
It's an extension of Ladakh or eastern Ladakh. But you will see, broadly speaking, a blank there, a blank space with regard to granular details. It doesn't mean that there aren't any villages or habitations on the Chinese side. So I think the time is ripe for some of us, maybe you and me, can sit together and think of some nice names, which we must actually, you know, bring others to accept, build a consensus and print them through the Survey of India.
Yeah,
I don't see any reason why we should not.
I remember we used to, Doordarshan started putting weather bulletin of Pakistan-occupied Kashmir. That why not?
Yeah,
you know, so when we talk about the weather in Jammu Kashmir, we will also talk about weather in
POK and Aksai Chin.
And Aksai Chin. Right. This is all the Saiwar which needs to be done.
Sir,
go ahead.
Sir, when think tanks interact, I think the discussions are quite free, frank. And the Chinese think tanks, they are extension of their government. They are not like think tanks in US, which say
or in India.
Or in India.
And I'm fairly autonomous, as you know.
Yeah. So, have they told you, or have they given you any reason why they did this in 2020? What was the purpose? What have they gained out of this aggression in Galwan and nearby places, where they tried to change the status quo on the LST?
So this is a question that is oft asked, and I must state quite candidly that the Chinese have not given India an appropriate reply or response. No convincing clear-cut response has been forthcoming from the Chinese side. The basic point here is that the Chinese believe that what they show as their territory or their so-called, you know, line of actual control is kind of fair game. And they've not really given us an appropriate response as to why they would move in a large body of troops, you know, who are engaged in a regular routine exercise on the Tibetan plateau, to wheel over, to try and take over some, you know, kind of advantageous positions along their so-called line of actual control. But one can speculate. One can speculate whether this is a message to India not to, you know, imagine that it can actually match up to China at a time when India has emerged as and of course, this happened before India's real emergence as the fifth largest economy and the fastest growing large economy in the world. But the trends have been quite consistent. The potential has been there. So they've always been a little wary of India emerging as a competitor. So was it to convey a message that China is, in fact, the big power in the region?
Yeah.
Was it a message to the United States not to imagine that India could be such a potentially great partner in whatever design they attribute to the United States vis-a-vis the so-called containment of China? Was it a message to India not to build an even closer partnership with America? Was it a message to India's neighbors to realize that it is China that is the dominant power in Asia? Was it something to do entirely with their domestic compulsions? At that point of time, they were under some kind of scrutiny with regard to their policies in Xinjiang, Tibet, Hong Kong, the South China Sea. And there was at that point of time also the looming, the 100th anniversary of the CCP and the Party Congress coming up. So was it to do with, the need to emphasize to the domestic audience that the centralized leadership is very much in command of everything in sight? It could be one or more of these factors. But that apart, I think the key point here is that China's militarization of its economic power, its unilateralism, its desire to spill over into the region without conversation, without confidence building, without transparency, is not conducive to better relations. Mm-hmm. It is something that does not make for a better and transparent relationship between two very large neighboring countries and the most populous in the world.
Ambassador Chinoy, I want to get now to what we had planned for the podcast, which is future wars and current wars and what India can learn from them. Let's go to the Israel-Hamas war first. I'm not going to ask you when it's going to end because it's anybody's guess. But what I want to know is what happens the day after when the war ends? What happens the day after? Will it mean elimination of Hamas? Will it mean establishment of supremacy of Israel? And will it mean creation and the formalization of the state of Palestine as not just a geographical or territorial, but actually nationhood for a country called Palestine? What does the day after mean when the Israel-Hamas war is over?
So I don't think there'll be a dramatic change in the nature of geopolitics in that part of the world. For you have to look at history. This is not the first time that the Israelis and the Palestinians have been engaged in a war. In the late 1940s, they fought a war. They also fought the Six-Day War in the 1960s, in 1967. Then again in 1973. And each time you've seen that the animosity, the adversarial nature of their relationship has continued beyond those wars. So I think that part of it would be a chimera to expect that this time around there will be a fundamentally different situation and a fundamental resolution.
So just a fractured situation?
So what I would imagine here is that Hamas is very difficult to eliminate, because you use that word. Even now, Hamas has not been eliminated. They continue to operate. They have actually, in that very small geographic space, including in areas that have been completely devastated, including, I understand, places like the Al-Shifa Hospital, etc., they have managed to stage a comeback. So they're a resourceful entity. Originally a kind of non-state actor that over time became a quasi-state actor, in fact a state actor. And when non-state actors transit into being quasi-state actors, and when they acquire political power and territorial control, they become very potent. We have seen that in the case of the Hezbollah, we have seen that in the case of the Houthis, and we have seen it in the case of Hamas. So Hamas is not something that, in my view, can be
eliminated
anytime soon. Right now, I think the best case scenario is for fighting to stop, for the hostages to be exchanged. And as India has said, There is no space here for terrorism. India condemned terrorism right from the word go when the attacks took place on Israel. But the second part of our position beyond condemning terrorism was also to reiterate our old position.
Two-state theory.
You require a two-state settlement there, a Palestinian state coexisting peacefully alongside Israel. In our case, of course, the concerns went beyond that to bringing back our people safely from that part of the world. And through Operation Ajay, we did get back about 10,000 people. So I think this time around, the UN Security Council has reached some kind of consensus on a ceasefire. I'm not sure how it's going to be implemented. Because the United States, after having vetoed the resolutions on earlier occasions, I think there were four before this one, and they were vetoed. Three of them were vetoed by the United States of America. This time around, the United States abstained, and it has therefore allowed the resolution to pass. But there's many a slip between the cup and the lip. So implementing a resolution is different from adopting a resolution, even by the UN Security Council.
But we're sending people. You talked about bringing people. We're also sending workers now to Israel. It's sending some Indians into the conflict zone yet again. Is that all right? What do you think?
Look, I don't think that in itself is a problem, so long as fighting doesn't get too bad in Israel itself. If fighting were to reach such a tipping point that all of Israel is on fire, then I would imagine we would want to bring our people back. And we would do so very quickly. This government has been particularly quick off the block in responding to the needs of overseas Indians, very mindful and sensitive to their requirements. And we have demonstrated our expeditionary capabilities on more than one occasion.
Yes. I'm going to go to the next war, which is the Russia-Ukraine war. 3 years plus now, no breakthrough. But the recent attack that you saw, you know, the terror attack that happened, the Russians blaming the Ukrainians for aggravating the crisis. What is the realistic estimate about whether this war will at all end, and what do you think when it will end?
So I think the broad indications today are that wars are not ending quickly. In other words, even when wars involve what appears to be belligerents that are not evenly matched, where absolute asymmetries exist in military power as well, it's not necessarily leading to decisive victories. This is because of the nature of warfare, which has changed dramatically, where it is possible for state actors that are lesser powers militarily, or non-state actors, or state actors and non-state actors acting in tandem against superior might, are in a position to use asymmetrical means to meet the challenge of a superior power. We saw that in the case of Hamas, where, for example, they used fairly cheap drones, small drones, to simply drop ordnance like grenades on the fabled Israeli surveillance system and watchtowers and surveillance cameras. So it's like using a simple grenade to bring down the surveillance cameras on a watchtower. Then they used hang gliders to motorcycles and all sorts of other equipment to cross over, bringing down the fences, etc., and then mounting what was an absolutely shockingly unanticipated attack.
Gruesome.
We are looking at wars that will stretch. It's impossible today for any one power to dominate in all geographies at all times on all issues. I mean, this is the nature of the world today. It's a flatter world. a more of a level playing field, and the technological revolutions have made it possible for lesser powers to bridge absolute gaps in comprehensive national power through asymmetrical means.
Asymmetric. I'm going to get to the asymmetrical.
So Ukraine and Russia, to answer your question, right. I don't see it ending anytime soon. Okay. More so because today it's not just a bilateral war. It's become, to my mind, a new theater for a wider proxy war, where, as you're aware, after 70, 75 years of peace in Europe, this war has upended and questioned the security that Europe enjoyed all these decades. And Ukraine has the backing today of the West, including the United States of America. So it's not a question of simply Russia and Ukraine sitting down together and trying to achieve peace. It's much more complex. And therefore, I don't see an early end to this war. The one more point I want to make is that, you see, in assessing relative strengths and making prognostications about warfare, one must keep in mind that large powers, militarily large powers, even if they appear spent, are hard to defeat in their own geographies. Hard to inflict an absolute defeat on major military powers in their own geographies. So it's a given that even the Soviet Union could be defeated in Afghanistan.
Vietnam War, we saw.
Well, the Americans could be defeated in Afghanistan as well. You had Korea, where MacArthur was pushed back after reaching the Yalu on the Chinese border. The American-led UN forces were pushed back to the 38th parallel. You also saw in Vietnam that America was defeated. But therefore, the moot question is, can Russia, a permanent member of the UN Security Council, but more relevantly, a country that possesses 6,000 nuclear warheads, can it be in a vast military-industrial complex, can it be conclusively defeated in its own geography? That's the moot question.
Right. Let me come to India in this. We just had a visit, Ukrainian visit. President Putin has mentioned it. And there's a lot of talk about India being part of a future peace plan, if at all. Will India be reluctant to sit on a table for a peace plan?
Look, India is the one country in the world today with a great deal of credibility. It has credibility because it is a country that is looking to build a values-based future for humanity through the vision of Prime Minister Narendra Modi. So we are talking about a vision which has been elucidated by the Prime Minister of India about a values-based future for humanity. India is also now increasingly a voice for the Global South. Some people like to say that India is a leader of the Global South. I am a little reluctant to use that term because it's not the most appropriate term to use for India, given that India wants to, be a part of the Global South and represent their concerns on an equal basis. India is not yearning to dominate the Global South through some kind of leadership. So therefore, India is a voice for the Global South. It also has excellent relations with the West, including the United States of America. It has very good relations with Russia. It has credibility with Ukraine. After all, we have, at the level of our Prime Minister, been speaking about now is not the time for war.
Wars.
The key point here is that this war between Russia and Ukraine should end sooner rather than later, and that their differences should be settled through dialogue and diplomacy. And meanwhile, we have actually extended humanitarian aid and assistance to the both of them. So we are a country with credibility. We are not fighting any proxy war. We are not associated with either party like many others. I can't think of any country other than India that could potentially play such a role. But for this to happen, in my view, my personal view, I would imagine that the Russians and the Ukrainians
would have to
request India, and the others who have interests in that war, as I said, parts of it are a proxy war as well.
Yeah.
That's a fact. Mm. Would also have to accept such a situation. Now, that in itself is not very likely, given that were that to happen, the discourse detailing would shift out of the war rooms of the West.
Mm.
Do you see that happening? I don't.
Yes. Complicated. Ambassador Chinoy, I want to point out, I want to bring your attention to this Washington Post article, which came last week. It says, preparing for a China war. The Marines, which U.S. Marines, are retooling how they'll fight. Now, it's about U.S. military's latest concept for fighting adversaries like China from remote strategic islands in the Western Pacific. Quite clearly, they're talking about a possible conflict situation with China attacking Taiwan. Do you see, and China has been making noises, they are not happy with the deepening security alliances which are happening in the Pacific, the Quad, all of them. Who's right, who's wrong, and do you see a conflict happening soon?
Look, the fact of the matter is that Taiwan is one of the potential flashpoints between the United States of America and China. We have to go back in history for that. You are aware that after the communists took over the mainland, the People's Republic of China was formed in 1949, and the Kuomintang had fled to Taiwan and announced that the Republic of China was operating from Taiwan, but that it represented the whole of China. In December 1954, the United States and Taiwan entered into a mutual defense treaty. And that eventually in 1979, after the rapprochement between China and the United States, translated and segued into the Taiwan Relations Act, the TRA of 1979, which also continues to give certain guarantees to Taiwan in light of the rapprochement between China and the United States in the immediately preceding years of the 1970s. And there are two key factors there. One, that the United States does not countenance the use of force. The U.S. has never taken a position on the territorial aspects of China and Taiwan. The U.S., in my view, has never questioned the territorial integrity of China. So that's not a question that the U.S. has visited. For that matter, not even with regard to Tibet, in terms of the special coordinator that they appoint. The special coordinator's job is not to see whether Tibet is right in claiming that they were never a part of China, or whether the Chinese are right in claiming that Tibet was always a part of China, but only to look to, protecting their culture, their language, and their religion, and things like that. So when we come to Taiwan, the second part of the guarantee that the United States had given to Taiwan through the Taiwan Relations Act was that until such time as they can sort it out peacefully, reunification, the Americans would provide reasonable quantities of, defense equipment to meet the legitimate needs of Taiwan. So Chinese have never accepted this. The Chinese have always said that the U.S. is an interloper as far as Taiwan is concerned, and it has no business being there, and it should not give any kind of aid, assistance, or arms to Taiwan. And they've also time and again repeated that Taiwan is an integral part of China. China also does not rule out the use of force. And for the nth time they have said that, but quite publicly they said it in the Anti-Secession Act of 2005. So that is the situation. Now, is a war possible? That is, again, a moot question, because it's not easy for the People's Republic to simply wade across the long stretch of water into Taiwan. It's not some kind of a cakewalk. Many things can happen in the intervening space. Boats could, an amphibian assault could sink to the bottom of that strait before getting to Taiwan. The more likely scenario about which people worry is an economic blockade. But I have no doubt that were a kinetic incident to take place for one reason or the other between China and the United States over Taiwan, that others might join the fray. I would say Japan in particular, and perhaps also Australia and some of the others.
The impact on India, I mean, if such a situation happens, there are several things that could happen with India. Can India not get drawn in if there is a war there? We'll get drawn in some way or the other. Just one point that I want to talk about is this, the semiconductor situation, where the Taiwanese firm has partnered with Tata. Now, they are building their first semiconductor fabrication plant here. If something happens in Taiwan, for example, even today when the earthquake happened, they had to evacuate their semiconductor chip factories today. So suddenly, they have got out of the factories. Now, suppose there is an active war which happens. What happens, what does it mean to India if a Chinese invasion of that kind? What happens to our semiconductor nascent steps that we are taking?
Well, this question, I think, applies to every situation. In a globalized world where there are such extreme interdependencies in terms of supply chains.
COVID taught us that.
COVID has already made you realize that dependency. And it gets more complex when you move from, you know, face masks and PPEs to more
chips.
You know, important things like semiconductors and chips. But that should apply to any part of the world today, because it's not only in the case of Taiwan. I mean, we have supply chains that are coming in from all parts of the world. So disruptions can take place in any part of the world. And I'm not quite sure if our destiny is linked only to semiconductors and that to coming out of Taiwan.
Sure, I'm just
for example,
giving one.
If I were just to spin it a little more, wouldn't that affect South Korea, Japan, China, the United States?
Absolutely.
Because Taiwan is a leading producer of semiconductors. It'll affect the whole world.
Yeah.
The nature of these supply chains today, especially in cases where certain geographies have created these oases of excellence they've created a certain amount of dependency for the rest on themselves. The nature of this kind of development in a globalized economy has implications for many more things, not just semiconductors. So,
because with Taiwan, I was simply saying it because we don't have a big diaspora there. Trade is also not taken off to such an extent as such. So the only thing that struck my mind was that this would impact us the most, I would presume. I mean, of course, there'll be other things too. I think India is now in a position where we have to take a stand. We can't just stay a neutral observer or not make a comment. It's come to that situation where we are pulled in.
And along with that, sir, we are a growing economy. Everybody says we are a regional power in the Asia Pacific region, entire region. So to add to this, sir, all this business would be affected. As you are saying, other countries would also be affected. But as a country like India, which has been, which is currently in a military standoff with China, how will India react, or how should India react if there is an invasion of Taiwan by the Chinese? How would India, there will be impact on business and other things with Taiwan, but how should India react? Should it be only about condemning the act, or would we get drawn into it from other corners? Or
I get your point.
How will India react?
So as far as semiconductors coming out of Taiwan are concerned, or Taiwanese collaboration with India, it takes years for semiconductor fabs and all to be set up. And therefore, this is not something that should be seen only in the moment. Taiwan has always been at a risk from China.
That's true.
And so one should not imagine that Taiwan is now at a risk. For the Chinese have never given up their right to usurp Taiwan, if necessary, through military means. And so I wouldn't worry too much about it. Because at the end of the day, before we worry, I would imagine Washington has a lot to worry about. Tokyo has a great deal more to worry about in regard to Taiwan being the object of Chinese military action. So I think we can keep that in mind and go ahead with what we are trying to do with Taiwan in terms of our technical collaboration, particularly with regard to semiconductors.
You know, you spoke about asymmetrical warfare, and we spoke about drones earlier. It's a new dimension, you know, new in the sense in 2 years that one saw whether it was the Hamas using drones, whether the Houthis. What lessons can Indian military strategists draw from this? Because my first thought would be that, you know, countries like us, which can ill afford to spend on importing weaponry, we buy aircraft, we buy weaponry from, and we use resources for that. And a drone can finish off these small organizations, small terror groups can get together and pull down a plane with just a drone. So how do Indian military strategists learn from these experiences?
So I think you're right in pointing out that drones have emerged as a very potent instrument of war. And if you use it positively, drones have many other uses, sure, as you know, in commerce, in healthcare, in all kinds of other delivery, surveillance, etc. It can be used for agriculture. But as far as the military is concerned, I think the pace at which technology is changing today is awesome. And the advent of, big data, the confluence at which it operates with artificial intelligence and information technology, this has made drones extraordinarily important to warfare today. You may be aware that the drones that, for example, the Houthis use are very potent, and they use, for example, an Iranian drone, believed to be of Iranian origin, called Samad. And it has a range of something like 1,100 to 1,500 kilometers. Of course, these are to be used one way. They're not expected to come
return back.
These are suicide drones. And they can threaten shipping not just in the Red Sea, but also in the peripheral waters of the Arabian Sea. And that is what is happening.
And they'll get superiority over these fancy equipment that is bought and fancy weaponry.
Right. Like what the Navy said when it was talking about it, 100 days of anti-piracy operations, that what they are doing is that they are using a four-stroke moped engine, filling it up with fuel, and it travels to around 1600 kilometers, and it's a 30,000-40,000 rupees drone. And if you are using a surface-to-air missile to put it down, you are using $1 million missile to put down a 30,000-40,000 rupees drone.
But Hamas did the same thing when they attacked Israel with homemade rockets. And using a very large number to overwhelm Israeli defenses.
So how do we strategize against this?
But everyone's using it. So therefore, India has to obviously take a deep dive into the same technologies, and not just drones, but also counter-drone technologies, which is what is happening currently. We have seen drones have devastating effect in the Armenia-Azerbaijan war, where the Turkish Bayraktar drone was very potent in the hands of the Azerbaijanis. We have seen how the Iranians have actually emerged as a drone maker, not just the Samad that they are giving to the Houthis, but there are other drones that they are giving to Russia, for example. The Ukrainians use the Bayraktar. The Russians are using Iranian drones. And so drones are here to stay. On our own Punjab border, you may be aware that, and I'm speaking of the Punjab border, not J&K, there are a very large number of drones that Pakistan deploys today to drop drugs, especially on our side, which are then quite apart from Indian currency or, weapons and things like
asymmetrical
that.
Asymmetrical again.
But they are creating what you call local financing of terrorism by simply sending drug consignments, which are then picked up and they wind their way into Kashmir, where they are turned into,
it's the 21st century opium war.
So it's a kind of 21st century opium war. And this is something that must be met with counter technologies. Mm. So India is also obviously investing a great deal of time, energy and money in drones and counter drones technologies. Mm. For example, the BSF in the past would have dealt with drones by keeping a watch, a lookout, to see if they can spot it in the sky, if they can hear the whir of its blades, or if they can, in fading light, see some, flickering light or some electronics that would give it away, and then try and shoot it down with an LMG mounted on a post. But today we are moving ahead and creating other means to bring down either electronic means or, direct energy weapons. There's so many things that are being looked at.
Okay.
Ways and means to scramble, the electronics of such drones or take control or simply, shoot them out of the sky or bring them down through such other means. So everybody is looking at it. And drones are not the only technology where this is moving forward. I mean, you have missiles are moving
at
a very brisk pace. Small weapon systems, which are in the hands of even non-state actors. That's the second part, really, is that were there to be some, action in the Taiwan Straits, what would India do? Well, I would imagine that India would have to take into account a very large number of considerations. Firstly, what is the expectation? Is it that because China and the United States have a military conflict in the Taiwan Strait or in the broader theater of the South China Sea or the Pacific, does India rush a boat or two or three to that scene? And if so, what does it do? How will it help? The United States has enormous resources there, such that a few naval assets of India are hardly likely to make a difference. The larger question is, why would India want to do that? I mean, it's not a war between India and China. If we have to look after our security, we would have to obviously fundamentally look to our continental challenges. And we have enough of a reason to focus on our borders, our continental borders. We have enough reason to also focus in the maritime theater around India, in the Eastern Indian Ocean and the Western Indian Ocean, to see that powers that are inimical to India are surveilled, are followed, whether it is a submarine or whether it is survey vessels. And so we have to obviously use our limited naval resources for a primary purpose, which is to ensure that slots remain open, that there is greater transparency and surveillance around India. So I don't see any realistic possibility of India jumping into the fray without due consideration. There's no reason to do that. You have to take into account that should India do that blindly, let's say, what are the consequences? Are you suggesting that China has absolutely no capacity or ability to either ratchet up, a pressure on the land borders? Are you imagining that? If they use that approach to ratchet up pressure, would India not be wise enough to harbor its resources to meet that greater challenge, which is fundamental to India's sovereignty and territorial integrity? Would you rather suggest that India fly out its expeditionary forces and boats simply to join the party somewhere else? And for what purpose and what reason? Because when you become a belligerent in wars, you must expect the frontage to widen and to open up. I mean, didn't Operation Gibraltar lead to Operation Grand Slam in 1965? Didn't it eventually lead to India widening the war to strike out into Pakistan towards Lahore? So wars cannot be imagined to be limited. They have the potential to expand with unpredictable consequences.
But with
if you have a good reason to join the fray in the Taiwan Strait, I would really like to know
but
more
about it. Operation Gibraltar and Grand Slam, we are the ones who took it to the Western Front then. It wasn't Pakistan which did it, isn't it?
No. You are aware that the trouble with Pakistan in 1965 started in Kutch.
Kutch.
The hostilities in Kutch in the summer of 1965 were limited to small bodies of troops, that's company level and battalion level, skirmishes, etc. Then there were negotiations, the kind of settlement with regard to Kutch, an agreement to offer that to arbitration, which of course took a couple of years for the report to come. And meanwhile, Pakistan had already started Operation Gibraltar, which is something that they had planned, and and so they took it further into Kashmir, and after that India also
they don't have a plan after that. What happens if the operation fails? That's one thing I've read often. I mean, of course, you would know better about Pakistan military strategizing, is that there is no plan B when they strategize. And that is why their several operations collapse, because they don't do a what if situation. What about India?
So we should.
We should.
So that's and you should also do that in the case of the question that our friend asked about the Taiwan contingency. The first thing that you should ask yourself is, what if?
What if?
And list all the what ifs. And the what ifs will bring you back to continental space. For what happens in the Taiwan Strait will not remain there. Mm. There is every likelihood that what happens in the Taiwan Strait would expand, radiate out into the Pacific, Western Pacific. Mm. It would also radiate out into the South China Sea. And if belligerents outside of the region are also joining the fray, then action would radiate out and spill over into our part of the world as well. I have very little doubt on that. Can I just quickly add a little bit about, our continental borders? Please remember, we have a very close strategic partnership with the United States. It's a very valuable partnership.
Actually, I was going to ask about that.
Yeah, but I just want to briefly tell you that the American position right from the time of Ambassador Galbraith in 1962 is that Arunachal Pradesh is NEFA, stroke Arunachal Pradesh is part of India, because they recognize the sanctity and validity of the McMahon line way back in October 1962. Mm. Having said that, it is equally true that as far as Aksai Chin is concerned, on the territorial aspects of India's claims, the United States maintains neutrality. And so it's a little anomalous there. So for strategic partners to become even more of strategic partners of the type that suggests that were there to be action in the Taiwan Strait, India should be forthcoming, one might raise this question.
You do this now.
At this stage, that does it then not behove our strategic partnership that the United States change its position and recognize India's claims to Aksai Chin, rather than maintaining neutrality? More fundamentally, both Japan and Australia regard Arunachal Pradesh to be an integral part of India, but equally and differently from the United States, they regard Aksai Chin to be an integral part of China. Might I suggest at this stage, in the excitement over the Quad and its future, including in the context of the Taiwan Strait, etc., that let us also try to get Japan and Australia to both at least improve their position and bring it up to the level of the United States. Might we suggest to them that their position on Aksai Chin should not be one which shows Aksai Chin as an integral part of China, but at least maintain neutrality if you can't do better than that?
Sir, this relationship between India and US, we have been, they have started calling their Pacific Command as Indo-Pacific Command. There's a lot of exercises happening, Tiger Triumph, Yuddh Shakti, Yuddh Abhyas. A lot of these exercises are happening all over the world. India going there, they coming here, Quad and all these. Now, all these exercises, everything goes on. The bond looks very strong. And then we say that we are the resident power in the Indian Ocean region. And then we have people like the Maldivian president who openly are siding with Chinese. They go to China, come back, make announcements, ask our military to leave from those bases. And they're totally looking as part of acting what we have been hearing about the string of pearls theory that the Chinese have taken over.
A chokehold
over India. So how do we see this happening? Now we are a growing power, growing economy. Maldives, they are closest to us. There have been situations where we have even supplied drinking water, daily drinking water to them. And then such a character
Operation Near.
Yeah, and such a character comes up and we have a situation where everybody says, okay, this guy is...
So I think it's important not to conflate the Maldives with the inimical power that is trying to enhance its influence there. You should not react towards the Maldives as you would towards the other. I think we have to maintain a certain balance in our outlook. It is a fact that as China has grown as an economic power, it has also grown as a military power. It has translated that economic power into military power, and some of that is now being used unilaterally for aggressive purposes. China is spilling over into new parts of the geostrategic space that it hitherto did not inhabit. It is doing it as what might appear to be a natural corollary to its newfound economic power and influence, but it has not handled it well. It is very sensitive to any presence of what it deems to be extra-regional powers in and on its periphery, but it is quite indifferent to the impact its expanding presence has on, for example, India in South Asia. Now, we are not saying that it should be by your leave, for everyone has a right to forge international relations, but it certainly does help if there is a conversation, if there is transparency. Before you, for example, formulate and implement a project like the CPEC as part of the Belt and Road Initiative, that you talk to India, you take into account India's sensitivities, that this is really passing through disputed territory. In fact, territory that is not disputed just between India and Pakistan, but it is disputed between India, Pakistan, and India and China as well. For, as you know, there are three parties to the Kashmir dispute, not two. For China is not only holding Aksai Chin, which is part of the erstwhile princely state of Jammu and Kashmir, but also in possession of the Trans-Karakoram tract of the Shaksgam, which is 5,180 square kilometers, no less, illegally handed over by Pakistan to China as part of their so-called boundary settlement of the 2nd of March 1963, very soon after the India-China war, in a very opportunistic fashion. So when it comes to the Maldives, I think my view is that we should be able to roll with the occasional punch and take a long-term view. For the situation in our neighborhood, in terms of their politics, which is their business, is not likely to remain static at all times. The last decade has shown how the transitions take place from Yameen to Soli to Moizu, etc. And so we should continue to do what we can for the Maldivian people, for example, to continue to build our credibility, not to throw the baby out with the bathwater. And of course, when it comes to, external powers trying to, inimical especially to our interests, trying to establish their presence there, which is harmful to our long-term interests, we must build up the capacities to be able to counter them in the local environment. I would take it that way. I wouldn't suggest that we, go with a battering ram batter anyone in our neighborhood that tries to have a dialogue with China. That would be counterproductive. I mean, it's a mug's game. to try and have a cage fight with China anywhere. One has to be, contemplative and wise about how to tackle this
newfound presence. Are they watching this Kachativu dispute which is going on? Or, I mean, is it just a political thing because of elections? But do you think they'll be watching what is happening between various groups in India and how Sri Lanka reacts to the Kachativu island?
Well, I have no comments on the Kachativu. Huh. I mean, you might know more about it than I do. But I would certainly say the Chinese would watch all this with great interest.
Okay.
For they have devoted considerable resources to the study of India and the
Indian
subcontinent
Ocean
and the Indian Ocean region. Mm. And in their centralized system, they have, as you said in the beginning of our chat, that they have so many think tanks, but they are all government think tanks. There is no such thing as an independent think tank in China. Mm. If they say that, then that's a figment of someone's imagination.
No independent newspapers, no independent
and
think
so
tanks,
they
everybody
have
is government.
Vast resources to devote to, in a very specialized way, not just linguistic, but also area specialists, people who study the economy of India, people who study the economy of our island neighbors, Sri Lanka, Maldives, Mauritius, Seychelles, you name it.
You were posted there at one point of time in Shanghai.
Oh, several times
several
in China.
Yeah. In China.
I lived in China for 10 years, over three postings.
One was in
I was in Hong Kong.
Oh, yeah.
Then
Hong
I was
Kong.
In Beijing. Huh. I was in Beijing from 1984 to 1987. Then I was in Shanghai for more than 5 years. Mm. So that's like about 10 in China, what is today China. And I spent another 10 years dealing back-to-back with China from the East Asia division. Hmm. So my
in the Ministry of External
that's
Affairs.
That's right. My MEA career of 38 years, close to 38 years, 37 and a half years, 20 were straight on China. Hmm. But then I also had to deal, among other things, with China as part of my 4 years in the National Security Council Secretariat, first as Joint Secretary and then as Additional Secretary in the Policy Planning Wing. Hmm. So to
China watching.
Did the government know about the history of your name, sir?
Why should the government be interested?
So they also entrusted you with the China they gave you most of your responsibilities
no,
to deal
with
China.
No, that's because I chose to learn Chinese. I had all the choices when
you
I joined the Foreign
Chinese.
Service.
Okay.
Yes, I speak it. As my first foreign language.
So if you could just explain, because we have some expats who, especially young students and of international relations, as to when you say I learned a foreign language, if you could explain why foreign service officers learn a language, what is the need and how do they do that? Yeah.
So in my case, it was a passion. And when I was growing up, I was fascinated by languages. And so when I went to college in 1975, I went to the Maharaja Sayaji Rao University in Baroda. After finishing school, my senior Cambridge from the Rajkumar College in Rajkot, which is India's oldest public school, as in the first of the three King's Colleges or Chief's Colleges, as they were called, set up in India. Mm. Mayo came 7 years later, in 1875, and the Rajkumar College in Raipur and all followed the Rajkumar College in Rajkot. I went to Baroda. The first thing I did was to sign up for a German language course for 2 years.
You'd already planned to join the Foreign Service by then?
Yes, I had. Okay. No, not by then. I had planned to join the Foreign Service when I was about 6 years old.
Why?
This is because my mother used to tell me when I was growing up, and my father was in the Indian Police Service, but she used to tell me that when you grow up, little fellow, it's not the IAS, it's not the IPS, it's the IFS that you should be joining. Huh. She had a very glamorous view of the Foreign Service. So I had really decided when I was six. People used to ask me, what do you want to grow up and be? Little kids that age would normally say, I want to be a policeman. Mm. Someone would say, I want to be a soldier. Mm. Usually the third one would be a pilot. Fourth one would be a locomotive driver, an engine driver. I used to always say, I want to join the Indian Foreign Service. And somehow you know, my life panned out that way. So I studied German for 2 years at the Max Müller Bauen. I did very well. I still have a pair of very fine German pens that were given to me for topping the course. Okay. And then I studied French for a while on my own. I studied Japanese for a while on my own. I used to spend all my you know, allowances to buy Lingua phones. And then I went to Japan as an exchange student in 1978. By then, I had shifted to Gujarat University to do my master's. I was doing an MBA and preparing for the civil services, and I had a chance to go to Japan. So I got interested in the Japanese language as well.
And you were posted later in Japan.
Yes, that's right. The wheel came full circle. I still have photographs of myself in my finest livery, suited, booted, and wearing a tie. Taking the Shinkansen, the bullet train from Osaka, where I was stationed as a student at the Otemon Gakuin University. And I went all the way to Tokyo with one of my professors to pay a courtesy call over a nice cup of tea on the then ambassador, Mr. Avtar Singh. He was a ramrod straight officer, formerly of the British Indian Army, who had joined the Foreign Service. And he happened to be there then. He received me and one other exchange student, a lady colleague of mine then, very well. I still have photographs of my sitting in the ambassador's office. Of course, years later, when I went as ambassador to Japan, that old building on the same street had been razed down to the ground, and an entirely new and very modern embassy building had been created. But I sat in the same, you know,
as of that
latitude and longitude.
Doyen, yes. So, before I come to IDSA, do you have any more defense related?
Can I say one more thing?
Yes, sir.
So, see, as far as German is concerned, you know, it's like this. If you work too hard at something, sometimes fate does not allow you to use that, you know. So, I never went to Germany on a posting in my entire life. I had never been to Germany, though I spoke German, and Chinese came into my life much later, only after I joined the Foreign Service. I had at least four other languages under the belt before I joined the Foreign Service. And last year, as things would have it, as you know, the full wheel of karma turned and came full circle, I went to Germany for the very first time in my life as the Think 20 chair for India's G20 presidency to attend the Global Solutions Summit hosted by the Germans. And I was part of the lineup that stood there, four or five of us, to welcome Chancellor Scholz. I began my speech. I was asked to speak there, and I began with a few remarks in German. And it really took the house by storm.
No education goes waste. I always feel that. Kahin na kahin to use ho jata hai. The collapse of West relations with Russia and the China-US competition, how dangerous has it made the world today in terms of the different wars that we have discussed right now? And do you see India having to make these very difficult choices as a result of that?
So I think the world has always been a dangerous place. During the Cold War, there was a different kind of subjugation. And there was a different kind of domination by the two superpowers. But it kind of fell into neat, you know, groups. And for those that didn't want to fit into either of the two groups, the East Bloc or the West Bloc,
there was NAM.
There was NAM, which was also, you know, not very clear about, you know, not all countries in NAM were really non-aligned. Many of them were also seen to be aligned with one or the other of the the superpowers on a need basis. And so today's issue-based alignment or multi-alignment is in some ways evocative of that period when NAM countries also did align. I mean, India also, NAM did not prevent India from approaching the United States of America in 1962 for, you know, war equipment and weapons. And Pandit Nehru had written to President Kennedy, and some of that aid came. But before too long, the war had ended. And in 1971,
to Russia,
NAM didn't prevent us from approaching the Soviet Union to strike out that treaty of peace, friendship and cooperation.
Hmm.
So I think the world has always been a dangerous place.
Okay.
But today I think it's different because in a way it's made it more difficult for the dominant powers or the major powers, and there's more than just two today. For others are growing and some are reducing in their reach and power. So we are looking at a world in which power is more fractured and more diffused. There is a rebalance of power that's strikingly apparent, as in the transition from absolute power in the hands of either the West or a large communist power like the Soviet Union. We see that today power, economic power, is actually more widespread, and that allows other powers to grow and also acquire military power and influence. So I think the world is really not very different. There are still attempts by, major powers to create constituencies.
Mm.
And so that does not exempt, for example, the United States or China from that list. The United States is still trying to build new partnerships around shared objectives and shared concerns, and we share so much in common with the United States. The Chinese, for their part, are also trying to create a parallel structure to the existing global order, in which they can actually sit in the driving seat and be the agenda setters, as in, for example, the AIIB or the New Development Bank of the BRICS or the expanded BRICS for that matter. So I'm not quite sure if the world is far more dangerous today. The danger comes from what you call asymmetrical threats or non-traditional threats. Those have risen as compared to the past. The threat of proliferation, WMD, chemical and biological weapons, these have risen as the number of players increase in a slightly more flatter world, as technologies make their way from state actors to non-state actors. The world has become more dangerous because of terrorism, because of the kind of influence that non-state and quasi-state actors are increasingly wielding. For example, the Islamic State, from being just a terrorist grouping, a reactive Sunni fundamentalist, part of a Sunni awakening in Iraq, it became the Islamic State in the Levant, later acquired territory, it acquired resources, later, of course, collapsed, and now again resurfacing in parts of Afghanistan as Islamic State Khorasan. So that makes the world dangerous.
Houthis firing ballistic missiles at will and at the most powerful nations in the world.
But could I say that the world is also more dangerous because of an unexplored theme called national identity? You see, in a globalized world such as ours, swarming with information, the traditional notions of national borders and identities has collapsed. Today you see the emergence of new constituencies of either the youth or left of center or right of center groupings and constituencies. You see NGOs that are global in nature and have global networks. And these do not see themselves in terms of national identities.
Mm.
So when you have a situation of the type that you see unfolding in Gaza, it is not unusual to see a youth constituency straddling India, Australia, the United States, Latin America, all relating to each other on the internet and social media and voicing the same concerns.
Yeah.
Sometimes these views expressed by these new constituencies are actually diametrically in contrast to the national positions taken by their governments.
So it's transnationality.
Transnationality. This transnationality for me is insidious and is a new kind of danger.
But sir, we can also use that, right? A country positively. Can use that positively. Yeah,
yeah. For so example, if you use it for climate change, if you use it for...
Even to fight against against proxy wars, like we can use this transnationality when we talk about second or third generation of our diaspora who are working. And you're seeing Israel using that very effectively, this transnationality in building a consensus, because it's been extremely difficult for Israel to do that over the years, over the decades that it's been fighting wars. But in 2024, they seem to be using it more solidly than in the past. That's what I would see from my perspective, but you might have a different view on this.
No, I agree with you. Huh. I think one of the great challenges that Israel is facing now is from this transnational constituency or constituencies that I'm referring to. And that's a different set of challenges.
Very interesting.
And it's not just Israel that faces that.
Yeah.
India also faces that. Time and again, you've seen that threat. It's a disruptive kind of presence, because when states also start taking interest in these transnational groupings that appear to be, say, for example, a youth segment or a student segment or a university segment, or for that matter, an NGO segment.
It's not benign.
It's not benign. It's never benign, because it involves vast sums of money and resources required to straddle the world.
Yeah.
And when such networks develop, states, deep states, always take immediate interest in it, because it's a way of advancing your own agenda without being identified.
Yeah.
And therefore, in my view, this is a new danger that many of us have to face.
Because one can even feel, palpably feel it when elections come. And you don't know how it seems like a coordinated thing to, you know, suddenly to say that it's autocracy in India, it's a democratic credentials of India are like sliding, and then happiness index comes out, then VDEM comes out with it. It seems like a very coordinated effort. It doesn't seem so. This is where I feel what you just mentioned about this identity and transnational, you know, it's small weaponry, if I was to use some of the metaphors that you've used.
And you don't know who's using it against you.
Yeah.
Because there's always that fig leaf of amorphous nature of the entities, and a facade that does not lead you to recognize who's behind it all.
Yeah.
So that part is very, insidious in my view.
Yeah.
And the other thing is that, you know, about democracy and backsliding and all that. I mean, frankly, you know, isn't it time that we should revisit the character of colonialism also? I mean, I was interested to see the other day, it's not my opinion, the UN website says that, there are 17 colonies in the world today. And there are four powers listed there as possessing those colonies. And many of them happen to be democracies. In fact, all are democracies. All are societies that advocate openness and transparency, occasionally speak about India's, internal affairs, about democratic backsliding in India. And I don't want to list them for you, because it's in the public realm. It'll be very interesting for you to see how four good friends and democracies are on a list of countries that maintain 17 colonies around the world. In this day and age, can you imagine? The 21st century, nobody writes about that.
I encourage viewers and listeners to do a quick Google search while I have Ambassador Chinoy out here. I can't believe that I'm concluding a podcast with or an interview of a DG of IDSA with barely skimming Pakistan. In my 30 years in journalism, IDSA interviews have largely been about Pakistan, and shows the inconsequentiality of that country today, that one hardly talks about them, you know, in discussions when we talk about wars, future wars and things. Of course, they are, it is a problem for us. I don't dismiss it, but it doesn't occupy so much of our conversations anymore. on that. Anyway, thank you so much, sir, for coming and spending time and demystifying international relations for us. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you for watching or listening to this edition of the ANI podcast with Smita Prakash. Do like or subscribe to the channel and share the conversation with those who you think will benefit from listening to them. Namaste. Jai Hind.